Hi there, and welcome to the Women's Room Legal Division podcast. Here you'll find conversations with fabulous women working in the law about their careers, challenges they've faced, as well as some live coaching around a specific issue. You'll also find some sessions with me alone, dealing with topics that come up regularly when I coach that I hope you'll find helpful. Enjoy this episode. So today I'm really excited to have Andrea Kuma with me. Andrea has had such a varied and interesting career. She is a woman working in the law, but actually in a very different area from some of my previous guests, as she is currently working in the third sector or charity sector in criminal justice. So very, very different to my private practice and corporate background, but working in an area that I feel very passionate about. As well as her career and thoughts on challenges she's faced during her career and her advice to her younger self, I'd love Andrea to tell us a little bit about two organizations that she has and is currently working for, and they are Justice, where she was previously CEO, and the Howard League, where she is currently chief executive. Andrea will tell us a bit more about the Howard League shortly, but it's a campaigning charity wanting to build a more humane and effective response to crime in England and Wales, which provides justice to all and helps to reduce reoffending. And if anyone can help change things for the better, it will be Andrea. As you'll see, she's incredibly bright, passionate, committed, always willing to go out of her way to help other people and act as a connector, and absolutely not scared to say what she thinks and to do it in a highly articulate and effective manner. So welcome, Andrea. Welcome to the podcast. I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about your career, because it has been so interesting. In fact, let me ask you, when you were young and people said, what did you want to do? So teenage years, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I always wanted to be Prime Minister.
Oh, did you? Wow.
Australia. Yeah, that never did happen. I always wanted to be, well, I think for a short period of time, I wanted to be a ballerina, but then my ballet teacher told me I was a baby elephant. So I then always wanted to be Prime Minister. I mean, around the time Margaret Thatcher had become Prime Minister here, my sort of 10-year-old self didn't understand the nuances perhaps of her, but I thought, oh, well, it's possible. So, I'll become Prime Minister of Australia. So that was my plan. I mean, I'm very interested, obviously, in politics. And in addition, actually, to being at the Howard League, I also sit as a lay member of the House of Lords Conduct Committee. And so I am in that political space, looking at conduct of members of the House of Lords, which is fascinating.
Yeah, hopefully you get less to do than in the Commons, but maybe you can't comment on that.
Very different to the Commons, but very interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, good. And so tell us a little bit about your career, how you decided to get into the law, how it worked out, and I'll ask questions along the way.
Sure. So I sort of did law by default, I guess, at university, and didn't really have a sense of what I wanted to do, except I did want to do medicine because I didn't like the sight of blood. So, and at the time I went to the University of Western Australia, and you did a year of another faculty, and then you went into the law school. And the top 12 in each faculty, I think, were offered a joint law, arts or science, arts or whatever. So I did arts law with history, and really messed around at uni. I mean, I started clubs. I was involved in debating. I started learning Esperanto and set up the Esperanto direction and didn't take it very seriously, but did quite well, I think it's fair to say. And then went and qualified for practice in a big commercial law firm.
Because although you were, I wouldn't call that mucking around. I think I'd call mucking around like not getting out of bed and doing anything. But you were clearly doing lots of different things and sort of interesting.
Yeah, I was doing lots of, I was a member of the University Senate, for example.
Right.
But I ran as a joke candidate and with a kind of serious angle, and I managed to get elected. So I wasn't like, having breakfast bongs and, getting drunk like some of the people at law school, but I was busy. I think I've always been quite busy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went and qualified working in kind of equal opportunity government practice with a bit of insurance, and absolutely hated it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the highlight of my day every few days was sneaking off to have sushi at one of those sushi trains with one of my fellow friends who's gone on to be enormously successful in the house. So it didn't do us either of us any harm. But I wrote sort of 11 months in, I wrote a list of all the things I was good at and all the things I enjoyed. And I think there were like two of them that I was ticking off by doing, by being at the firm. So
that's quite an interest, because actually that is something that I often get people to do, is to, in fact, I'm doing some coaching on branding today. And even with branding, I get people to think about, what are they good at? What do they enjoy? What gives them a buzz? What do they want to contribute? In order to start defining, I mean, I guess what their goals are, what do they want to be? How do they want to be perceived for branding? But it's interesting that you, with no help, you sort of came up with that on your own, that you'd write this list of like, I'm not happy, so let's have a look at what's really going on here.
Yeah. Well, I figured the things I needed to be happy were to feel like I was good at things.
Mm-hmm.
And to feel like I was making a difference, so sort of like having, I mean, I've always been very purpose-driven, mm-hmm. no question. And then what I enjoy doing. I mean, you spend a lot of your life at work.
Yeah.
So I've kind of very early on realized that I didn't want to spend that time doing stuff I didn't enjoy,
yeah.
or that I didn't think was valuable, which is obviously limited to a degree, you know, what you can sort of then do. But yeah, I wrote a list. I mean, I think one of the things that was on the list that I thought I was doing in my job was talking on the telephone. I mean, that's how base it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked around at the people who were there, and at the time, you know, it was a magic circle sort of firm, but there was only one female partner.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd look at lots of the male partners and just think, really? Like they were good at their jobs, but only because they'd done them for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like at university, my friends were incredibly bright and sort of engaging and engaged. And I didn't get that from people who are in the partnership. So they weren't very inspiring to me, I think it's fair to say.
Mm-hmm.
As I looked at them and thought, gosh, like I don't want to be like that.
Yeah.
So I called up the legal practice board and asked them how many, like, did I have to do 12 months to qualify or could I get away with 11 months and a month's leave? And so I was told I could do 11 months and a month's leave. So at 10 months, I actually handed in my resignation.
Wow. Okay.
I did not want to be there.
And with a few, did you know what you wanted to do at that point? Had you worked it out?
No, I don't think so. I mean, no, I didn't know. I'd done honours in law. And so I went back to do honours in my arts degree. And I just taught, I ended up teaching like trusts and commercial law and stuff at a smaller law school, which I absolutely was terrible at. But and over that time thought, okay, I want to get into human rights. But I mean, human rights at the time were not a thing. Like in my law degree, there'd been one course that was a 6-month course called Human Rights and Equal Opportunity. That was it. And we were all told that, you know, human rights or international law, which we had to do, was something you were doing for interest only. None of you will ever get a job in it. It was all dreadfully inspiring. So I decided...
Why would you do it then if it wasn't like sexy at that point? And why did you think, oh no, actually there's something here that I think I could do or I want to do?
I wanted to make the world a better place. It sounds stupid. I've always been driven by feeling like I was really very lucky. Like I grew up around lots of deprivation. I grew up in the bush and most of the kids I went to school with, you know, didn't have anything that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of Indigenous kids who were dropping out of school and in problems with the law. And I always sort of felt like I was very lucky and therefore should kind of make the most of what I had. And so, and I guess that's kind of why I did law, is it could have been politics or journalism, but for me it was kind of law. And I think I saw potential in law, even though that wasn't drawn to my attention. So I'd sort of read, you know, Brown versus Board of Education and Roe versus Wade and saw that law could change things for people. But that really wasn't on offer at the commercial law firm I was working at.
Mm-hmm.
And also wanted to kind of get away and have an adventure. My then partner and I, he was a couple of years older than me. So we wrote to 10 NGOs in Asia and said we were Australian lawyers willing to come work for nothing. And they all rejected us except for one guy in New Delhi. Who said, sure, come along. So, and after 2 weeks, he offered me a full-time job earning a princess sum of $5,000 a year.
Excellent.
Which was fine, mm-hmm. like more than to live on. And that was working for a regional human rights organization.
Okay.
So I was very quickly able to put my talents to use helping victims of torture and executions and working on reports on religious minorities, working on a report on prisons in India, mm-hmm. Which is interesting, on women's prisons. So, yeah, and I was 25, and it was a completely kind of immersive sort of cultural experience.
How did that feel, like leaving home, going off to a completely different country, but also dealing with the subject matter that in itself, you know, can be quite traumatic, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing is I didn't do medicine because I didn't like the sign of blood. And then I all of a sudden found myself in an office with, you know, grown men coming in and taking off their shirts to show me the scars from their torture. And I don't know, like I just ended up having the stomach for it. Mm-hmm. Not if people don't, you know, it's just not for everybody. Mm-hmm. So it was incredibly rewarding. I mean, I became pretty obsessive work-wise about it. And we'd have these American interns come from Yale and Harvard who were like so cool, you know, compared to sort of somebody from a small kind of town in Western Australia, you know, who were just completely driven and had a really strong sense of themselves. And I didn't. I had a really strong sense of myself, but I didn't have a strong sense of what my career trajectory was. Mm-hmm. Any sense. I was more just like a sponge soaking up all of the experiences and learning a lot, and had a fantastic boss who really included me from day one in the running of the charity as much as in all of the influencing and work. So I learned huge amounts. Mm-hmm. Probably helped. I helped a few people. Like I got some people asylum and wrote some interesting reports. I wrote a school book for children called A Step in the Right Direction about human rights.
Wow.
Yeah. That ended up, I think, not becoming necessarily a big bestseller, mm-hmm. But ended up on the curriculum in India. So that was
amazing.
Exciting.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Because I was going to ask you, like, I mean, a bit like working in criminal justice. I mean, when you work in these areas where there's just so much change required, did you ever feel like this is futile because, you know, I help one person and there's, you know, another 1,000 outside the door? Do you ever suffer from that? Is that something?
I mean, I think I've always had a sense that I do what I can. I'm not mm-hmm. going to be able to help every single person. And, you know, people would often say to me, like, you know, why you, they come back from Australia, from India to Australia for Christmas or whatever. And I'd tell people what I was doing and they'd be like, oh, that's all very depressing. Like, why would we, it wasn't even a good thing to do, let alone a legitimate use of a law degree. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of the late 1990s, mm-hmm. not seen as a valid thing to be doing with a law degree. I can remember sitting next to a diplomat at a dinner and sort of saying, this human rights thing, Andrew, you know, you have to get over that at some stage and go back to have a proper job. I think it's just not a proper job. Mm-hmm. Whereas I felt like I was able to help individuals expose human rights violations in India within the UN system, which was part of my job. So I felt like, you know, there was terrible stuff happening in the world and I was doing my little bit to be able to help it a bit. And I don't think that's really changed. I mean, much as my job now is about kind of revolutionizing the way we approach punishment and imprisonment, and that's the organization's mandate, you know, you don't do that alone and you can't possibly try to do that alone.
Yeah. Can I just ask a bit of a segue, going on a tangent in terms of advice for people who, you know, young people at the beginning of their career, because obviously now a lot of people are like, want to be purpose driven and are like, I'd love to do something in human rights, but it's hard. What advice do you give people who come to you and say, I want to get involved in campaigning or human rights? Do you talk to them and give them advice?
Yeah, I do all the time. I mean, like I think last week I gave advice to 3 or 4 different people. Yeah. I mean, often they're people who have been working in a law firm and want to kind of move out. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Like, whereas when I was applying for jobs in the 1990s, you know, there weren't lots of jobs, but there were, nobody was wanting them. Like there wasn't, you know, and I did in my head develop a bit of a crazy kind of thing where I'd work on Saturdays and Sundays thinking, if I don't do this work for this Afghan refugee, then nobody else is going to, mm-hmm. Which is not healthy. But anyway, whereas then kind of 10, 15 years later, I was running a legal team at InterRights and I was rejecting people with PhDs from Stanford who spoke 4 languages for internships because it had all of a sudden become a sexy, more than valid use of a law degree, a desirable thing to do with a law degree. So that's definitely changed. I mean, I advise people to actually recognize how competitive it is now. I mean, I think, you know, there are kind of a handful of jobs for human rights lawyers, if you're being perfectly honest, across the planet. So you need to distinguish yourself from all of those other people who are wanting those jobs. And you do that by getting, I don't think you can get by without a decent master's degree from a good university. Which, I mean, I did that. I went to the London School of Economics and topped the law course. I applied myself in my master's, unlike my undergraduate, but I'd already kind of been in the sector to learn languages. If you speak languages, learn languages. But the most important thing, if you want to do international human rights work, is you need to move internationally. You need to get grassroots human rights experience. And that's the thing I think that trips people up. And frequently when I was at InterRights, I'd have people calling me up sort of quite angry that, you know, they've got a PhD from Oxford and they speak Chinese and Arabic, you know, and why haven't I shortlisted them? And I'd say, well, you know, these are the people I have shortlisted and they've been working for grassroots organizations in Botswana and like they've worked in Negro. You know, they have actual experience of what we're talking about when we talk about, you know, torture of people or denials of rights. So I think getting real experience is important. You can also, I mean, I think it's, you also can, I think it's important that people who don't go down that route, who choose to go to big firm law or in-house, can recognize that they can also really make a contribution. Like, you don't have to give up your job and work on fresh air and commitment like me. You can, like some of the people I know who've gone to the city, made a lot of money, you know, have done extraordinary things through philanthropy and, you know, joining boards and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, you do. Like, you know, you've built a do-gooding world on the back of your work in the city. And that's also incredibly valid and valuable. And charities like the ones I run wouldn't be able to survive without support from people who have chosen a different path for themselves. But try to do good through other ways. So it's just not for everyone, this kind of pretty peripatetic, low pay sort of life that I've chosen. I'm not sure if I necessarily understood all of those things when I chose to go down that route, but
And I think we talked about, like, maybe we'll talk about it later when you're talking about advice to yourself, but thinking about what do you want out of your life longer term when you're starting out, not with a linear plan, because obviously you need to be flexible, things might change, completely different things might come up, but what sort of life are you going to be happy moving around a lot and not getting paid? Yeah, that well.
It's interesting. I talked to one young person last week. She's in her early 30s. And I sort of said, you know, this sort of route is a low pay route. So, I mean, I can remember years ago having an argument with one of my bosses about my pay when I first joined InterRights. And she said, you shouldn't do human rights work, Andrew, unless you have a trust fund or a rich husband. And I said, but I don't have either of those things. She said, well, in that case, you need to get another job, you know, which was pretty awful. And it's not like, I mean, obviously we try as much as possible to give people a living wage, but there's no point pretending that getting a job at the Howard League in our legal team is anywhere comparable to getting a job in a city law firm. I mean, I earn, I think, the same as a newly qualified person at Freshfields.
Yeah.
And I've been practicing for nearly 30 years and I'm honorary King's Counsel. And, you know, like I know I'm guessing a bit more about some stuff than a newly qualified person. But that's just not, the work is not valued in that way. And it's easy. This girl last week was saying, you know, well, I don't care about earning very much money. And I thought, well, you don't care now, but when you've then got a family or, you know, you find yourself, I mean, I've ended up being a single parent, but, you know, you do care about those sort of things. But it's, you know, it is more complicated than what your 20, 30-year-old self thinks it's going to be.
So you're in India. What happens next in terms of your career path?
I probably would have stayed forever because I was so happy and found myself, really thriving work-wise and learning loads. But my then partner was miserable. So he got a job in London working for a gas company somehow. And I got a job in Geneva working for a UN-based human rights organization for a year. And the idea was that I'd then go to the London School of Economics and do my master's in international law, which is what I did. And during that time, he moved to Egypt. So I was commuting between Egypt and Geneva and then London and Geneva. It was a bit crazy. I can remember one day turning up to the airport on a Friday afternoon for a flight to Cairo and the check-in lady saying to me, you know, where's your luggage? And I said, I don't have any luggage. I'm just going to for the weekend. And she looked at me and said, my life's very different to your life, which it definitely was. And then after 2 years of living apart, I moved to Egypt after I finished my master's and was kind of there. I wasn't legally allowed to work in Egypt, which was incredibly frustrating. Mm-hmm. So I rode my horse around the pyramids every morning at 7 o'clock. And then read lots, and I did a bit of consultancy for the then High Commissioner Mary Robinson in Southeastern Europe and Croatia and in Southeast Asia.
We can't move on that quickly from riding your horse around the pyramids.
Oh, at 7 o'clock so good. In the morning. I know. Asira, beautiful horse. So I would go out to the pyramids every morning and ride her. I got permission from the oil and gas company to drive my own car because we all had drivers, but they didn't start that early. So it was a big controversy that Justin's wife wanted to drive her own car.
Well, I presume at that time there weren't tourists, like it was too early for the tourists to arrive, was it?
It was quiet. No tourists, really quiet. It was just all the stable boys getting the horses ready. So it was fantastic. And then I'd go back to the stables and have a cup of tea with the stable owner. And yeah, it was amazing. I did it 7 days a week. On Sunday,
great way to start your day.
Oh, it was amazing. It was beautiful, but it only kind of filled in 2 of the hours.
Right.
It's like during the pandemic, I was back in Australia and my friends and I do ocean swimming and we'd swim every morning. And it was just beautiful, like to wake up, go for a really long swim. And this is in Perth in Western Australia. It's glorious. And then go and have a cup of tea and chat. And that's all finished by kind of 8:30. And then it's like, oh, but now there's the rest of the day.
Right.
My rest of my day. And that's where I sort of struggle. That's where living in my work life in London is better for me. Because for the rest of the day, I am happier. Although the mornings are never as good as they were when I was in Cairo.
No, so I can see that.
Yeah, and that was amazing. And yeah, I still go back there and ride when I can. I ride like an Egyptian stable boy. That's the ride. So, and then... my relationship came to an end and luckily at that time I applied for a job at Interrights, which had been set up in 1982 by a number of English barristers to be a kind of international chambers doing international litigation. So I got a job as an equality lawyer there. Okay. and started that in 2002.
In London?
In London.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was funny because when I'd studied here, I absolutely hated it. I mean, I loved the study and I loved my friends and everything, but I just thought the UK was a stupid place to live. Like the LSE would be a whole lot better if it was in any other location. And then I took a job in London, which we used to call it Rock. Like, why are you going to go back and live on the Rock? So I got a job on the Rock and actually ended up being very happy here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was doing a quality litigation. So. Mm-hmm. Very early disability litigation, the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities is being elaborated, so I was involved in that, doing work on gender-based violence, rape, domestic violence, homophobic abuse, before regional courts. So we took cases, we supported local lawyers in Eastern Europe to take cases to the Strasbourg Court, mm-hmm. cases to the African Commission from African jurisdictions. So it was an awful lot of travel.
Right.
And then, like a lot, mm-hmm. Frequently be out of the country. So kind of months at a time, mm-hmm. like back for a day to do some laundry and then off to another continent.
And you were a single mother by then. So you took your...
I wasn't a mother. I was just single. I was single.
Oh, you had a baby by then. Yeah.
Okay. I had a baby by then. So this is 10 years before my baby, massively.
Okay.
Longer. Yeah. So I was, the baby came through it. Non-husband man. I just meant
a non-husband man.
Non-husband man. So I was doing that. And then eventually I did end up in a relationship, but I did end up having a baby. Mm-hmm. And that's when that became all a little unsustainable. So I can remember being on a flight to Nairobi, as was kind of the way. And my then partner had a big job. He couldn't possibly have been helping with childcare. So I just take my child on to work with me in Nairobi or Strasbourg or wherever, and he'd have local childcare. And again, getting on the plane, like the whole of the kind of crew, the service crew knew his name and knew my name and thinking, God, there's something wrong in the whole cabin crew of a flight to Nairobi, know your child's name. By the time he was 2.5, I thought, oh no, this is not great. And around that time, I was approached for the job at Justice.
Okay.
By then, I'd been the legal director at InterRights for 5 years, managing a legal team of 11 people who were taking all kinds of different cases. So lots of the Guantanamo litigation, cases on education, on health rights, all kinds of stuff, torture.
So that sounds like it was a really fulfilling time.
It was. Yeah, it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I learned a lot. I mean, in part because during that period of time, the organization had really poor, had one, in the 10 years I was there, we had one really great chief executive who'd come over from the European Commission, but he only stayed for 3 years because of some kind of thing. You had to go back to the commission. And then the rest of the time, there was either not a person in post or the person wasn't so great. So I kind of had to step up a lot, which wasn't a bad thing. I had one really bad manager. Mm-hmm. A lot from, which was at the time I wasn't loving it, but I did learn a lot from him.
Actually, one question that might be interesting to talk through is like your advice on if you have, you know, sometimes you have an amazing boss and that's brilliant. Sometimes we have more indifferent or you're actually worse than that boss. Do you have any advice for people about how to deal with a boss that isn't the best boss you could possibly have?
I mean, I think you obviously have to try as much as you can to manage upwards. And I've had some great bosses and I've had a couple of ones that are a bit so-so. I had one who was pretty bullying, which was quite pleasant. And in the end with that, I sort of thought that I wasn't actually going to be able to do anything about her. So I just had to leave.
Okay.
So I approached the chair of the board and asked for a reference for a job I was applying for. And they said, why is that? And in the end decided that she should leave rather than me and the other.
Okay. Because I think one of the things that often people
do. But it was really stressful because you said, well, they're not going to choose me over her, like because they're a senior person.
Yeah.
I've always had a pretty strong sense of what I'll put up with and what I won't put up with.
Right.
So that hasn't been a struggle for me.
And I think that is one thing that people struggle with. You see them staying in very unhealthy situations and not saying, this is enough, I have to move on. I mean, I do think like telling organizations, we know it can still be problematic and difficult and people worry about their careers. Hopefully that's changing with, you know, more of a transparent approach to not just whistleblowing, but, you know, raising concerns and giving feedback. But yeah, I think that is one thing I would say to people.
I mean, it's something that I get contacted by people who have worked with me in the past, not infrequently at all, about, you know, about the position that they're in now. And I always tell them to talk to somebody, you know, ask for help.
Yeah.
You know, and often the kind of behavior they're describing is really unacceptable.
Yeah.
And they're kind of putting up with it because they feel like that person's the boss.
Yeah.
I mean, what's interesting is, I mentioned, I get asked to give advice to people. And oftentimes people call me from big city law firms and say, I really want to like get away from this toxic environment and big city law firm and work for a lovely NGO. And I have to say, like, NGO culture is just bad. A lot of the time it's really unhealthy.
Yeah.
It's behaviours that occur in charities that wouldn't last for 5 minutes at Clifford Chance or Linklaters.
Like, yeah.
You know, because everyone's there driven by, you know, some kind of moral kind of superiority in a weird way. And so you couldn't possibly imagine that anyone be mean to people. But I've seen behaviours in charities that have been absolutely atrocious.
Yeah.
So I think you really do then just need to work out what you're prepared to put up with and not put up with. And you need to say, you know, I'm leaving because of it and realize that you have options. And if it's happening, the other thing is, I think if it's happening to you, it's happening to other people. You know, it's really rare that you're the only person that that's happening to. So you do need to kind of not band together, but you need to say to people, I'm not happy about this. And in the end, it was a couple, like it was me and another colleague who kind of, you know, advocated for ourselves in a way that made we kind of stood the test of time.
Yeah, good. Okay, so then on to Justice. I was just wondering, could you just tell us a bit about Justice? And because I think It's interesting. I think the bar, so barristers seem to know a lot more about justice than I would say like solicitors and law firms. Oh. It'd be great to do a little plug for justice. What is justice? And then
So justice has been around since 1957, and it was set up by Hartley Shawcross, who'd been the prosecutor at Nuremberg. And it was meant to be a kind of way of advocating for the fair administration of the rule of law. And that's what it's done for more than 60 years. It's done that. And it does it through drawing together its membership. And as you've said, it's got a really strong membership at the bar. A lot of the senior judiciary, retired judiciary, have been members of justice for many, many years. It was just something that you kind of was expected to be, you know, you're expected to join justice.
Oh, interesting.
Of, you know, your values. And then, yeah, so it pulls together its membership to come up with ideas for law reform change. And a lot of the things that are kind of parts of the system we take for granted, like the Judicial Appointments Commission or the Ombudsman, were all things proposed by Justice over the years. Solicitors should definitely be signing up to support it. I mean, it was the first organisation that said that solicitors should be able to become judges, which is very controversial in 1972, mm-hmm. when it was very strongly the view that solicitors were not suitable at all for the bench. it's done great work since then. So I was the chief exec there from 2013 until 2021.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, I was thinking back last night because my big kind of career moves have been moving from, I guess, Egypt to inter rights, and then moving from inter rights to justice, and then from justice to the Howard League. And each one of them has been precipitated by something, was been happening simultaneously with something in family life. So My first was the divorce, obviously, that I then came to inter rights rather than, I guess, going back to Australia, which is what he did to, you know, have very happy, he has family life in Australia now. The second was having a child and thinking, God, I can't keep up all this international travel with the mm-hmm. child. And then the third was during the pandemic. I was back in Australia nursing my mum through late stage cancer. And this opportunity, I mean, I'd been a member of the Howard League for years. And when I was at Justice, I used to go and teach at a law program at Warren Hill, which is a prison in Suffolk.
Mm-hmm.
Found it really rewarding, and I really enjoyed spending time with the men, and it's a category C prison. So this job, I'd always sort of thought that if the job at the Howard League ever came up, I would consider applying for it. And mm-hmm. then during the pandemic, it did. So I applied online. My interviews were all online from Australia while I was nursing mum in my last interview on her 75th birthday, which was her last birthday. So it just was like funny timing, I guess.
But
I kind of moved, this latest move to the Howard League has been a combination of head and heart. So the course I taught on at Warren Hill was run by Jack Merritt, who was killed at London Bridge in a terror attack. And so part of it was sort of thinking, oh, Jack's never going to be chief executive of the Howard League, which is the world's oldest prison charity. It's been around since 1866. So... and then it was actually head, because at InterRights I'd been doing lots of human rights litigation. That's all I did, was take cases to international courts. But we didn't have the kind of comms and policy work as an international organisation that I felt you needed to do to a really successful strategic litigation. Mm-hmm. And the Howard League for like 106 years nearly has been amplifying messages around how bad prisons are and what's happening in prison. And we've got an incredibly... able comms team, and pretty much every story about prisons is somewhere our comms team have got a hand in it. So I wanted to marry those two things, marry the comms and policy with the litigation. And that's kind of where we are, I've moved the organisation to, because when I started, the legal team only worked on children and young people. So mm-hmm. we have an advice for children and young people in custody, which is amazing and is an incredible gift. I mean, everybody listening to this will understand the importance of good legal advice. And kids in prison couldn't really be more vulnerable. No, it's not really anybody more vulnerable, I don't think, than 14, 15-year-olds who are taken away from their families, and most of them are still on remand. So, and it's incredibly vulnerable. But we're now, in addition to doing work with children on the advice line, looking to challenge prison conditions and other things.
Right. And I want to talk to you a bit more about that. But can I ask you before, like, what was it like stepping up to be chief executive? Like, that's a big move. It's a move obviously a lot of people want to make in their careers. What think about it? What did it feel like? What did you learn from doing that?
I mean, I was lucky because in many ways, I'd been the legal director at InterRights for 5 years. So I'd been involved and I'd been managing a team of 11 people, which was too much of a span of control. But anyway, it had presented lots of good management and human resources challenges. And for a fair bit of that time, we didn't have a chief exec. So I had to do a lot of that role already. So I kind of knew what I was doing. I knew what I was doing a bit. I started at Justice, though, there were only 5 members of staff. So it was a much smaller team, which gave me much more space to think and plan. And there wasn't, you know, there wasn't really a lot of money. There wasn't a lot of strategy. So I was kind of starting it all afresh. And I've had to do much the same at the Howard Legal, though there are many more people. My predecessor had been in role for 35 years. So there's a lot to kind of unpack. And obviously with any transition in leadership, there comes a refocusing of strategy and setting up lots of back office things. So updated our charitable objects and set up a finance committee and all of these sort of things, in addition to deciding that actually we're going to focus on lifting the lid on how bad things are in prison and doing litigation, comms and policy work around that.
Yeah. So it seems like some management experience is pretty foundational, taking on a role like that.
Yes, but I've also been always really good at asking for help. I'm a big help asker person. I don't have all the answers, or pretend to have all the answers. I'm not even close. But I tend to know people who can help me. So I, over time, whether that's help, you know, asking people at law firms, like, you know, can you help? We've got this human resources problem. I don't suppose your human resources team would be willing to help us. They are. Like, they'd love to. You know, just asking friends who know people who I don't know if they can make connections, all of that sort of stuff, has been really helpful. And then in like halfway through my time at Justice, I got a coach. So David, who was terrific, and he was helpful at dealing with some knotty kind of management-y sort of things, I guess, but also in thinking about what I wanted to do, like with my time and what I would be good at. And this with not with a view to actually leaving, but just having a sense of direction of what I should be doing to set myself up, I guess. Yeah. And I didn't do any of those things. I mean, they didn't actually, I think, probably help me at all, because I, other than just knowing that I wanted to work in the prison sector, which he did help with. But at one stage I was thinking about doing a portfolio career because I have the job on the House of Lords, and one of my members of that was saying, you know, you should do this, like I'm doing this commission. And blah, blah, blah. And with his help, I realized that that's just not for me. Like, I just need more structure than that. If I was to leave myself to have your day, Erica, I'm sure I'd just stay in bed with a book and like maybe gym and have a sauna. That'd be it. That'd be done. So I think I do need kind of a bit more routine than that.
What do you think about coaching in terms of like as a you know, how did you find it? What do you think about it? Is it?
I mean, I think it's enormously beneficial. I think it gives you time to like a space and time to step away from whatever crisis you're dealing with or you're dealing with on a daily basis and kind of interrogate your thinking and your plans and to set priorities and all of that. I mean, certainly my time at Justice, there were periods where I really, really needed it and it was sort of urgent and I couldn't doubt it. And then I went for a few years where everything was kind of cruisy and it was still really nice just to touch base. And that's when we started thinking about, you know, what I actually might want to do next. But it does, I mean, look, as you know, I'm frequently referring people to you for coaching because I'll be in conversations with people who I care about or whose work I care about. And I just don't think I'm the best person to give them advice because I have skin in the game in one way or another, in a way that a coach doesn't have skin in the game.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's because although people, you know, people come to you for advice, when in coaching, as you say, the biggest thing is the space, getting away from the day job, thinking much more strategically about your life and your career, and having someone there to support, but also challenge you, who doesn't have any sort of agenda. And then for me, the biggest thing is people hearing themselves talk out loud is they know most, you know, most issues and problems. So you can give, you know, talk about your experience or talk about psychology, but a lot of it it's within people. They just need to bring it out and have that support and challenge. So that is the great thing. So now we're coming towards the end of the podcast. So I want to ask you, can you think about what three pieces of advice would you give to your younger self?
How much younger?
It's up to you.
I'd be loath to give myself advice. I mean, I think I've done quite well to get where I was in all of the circumstances, because there wasn't really a set route. Like, there wasn't a plan. I just kind of seized opportunity. So I guess the first thing would be just to continue to follow your instincts and trust yourself to do different things and to see value in building up skills and experience that might be objectively leading nowhere and not part of a proper job. Second one would be to ask for help, like just to keep asking for help. And I mean, I think probably pretty early on, I was quite a vulnerable leader, I guess, because I sort of had to be. Like, even at Justice, I can remember, you know, because I was a single parent for most of the time I was at Justice, in fact, all the time I was at Justice, there would be things I couldn't do. And I just have to say, look, I can't do that because I've got a small child. And I've really seen your judges say, well, in that case, like, why don't we go to McDonald's for our meeting rather than to the Delaney? And I'd say, great. On a school holiday, like, Henry would come along to a meeting with a really senior judge at McDonald's, King's Cross.
That's amazing. I mean, I think it's getting better, but I think a lot of women feel like they can't say that sort of thing. They have to basically pretend they can do everything and they can perform in exactly the same way, exactly the same hours as someone who doesn't have childcare or isn't looking after parents or have some other issue in their life, which might be the menopause, for example. I think being brave enough to say, I can't do it that way, because most people think that means that you're not going to have a job or a client but look at you with the most senior judges getting them to McDonald's at King's Cross. I love that image.
but I think it's also important for the people you manage, particularly the women you manage, because, you know, I think there's a danger if you make it all look easy and that you can just easily balance everything, and like that women will look up to you and think, oh, I can't possibly do all that.
Yeah.
I'm never going to be able to. And I don't in any way pretend that any of it's been easy. It's not easy at all. Yeah. Like, I'm just doing my best on a daily basis every day. Yeah. And some days are definitely better than others. But I'm pretty good at giving myself slack. And I'd very much hope that the people who I manage do that as well. But I don't think there's any point in pretending that our lives are as simple as men who have, you know, a stay-at-home wife. There's nothing wrong with that. But, like, that they have that kind of support structure.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that it's the same. And like in my case, it's been single parenthood. It's been not earning huge amounts of money. So I've never been able to afford a nanny I had an amazing childminder. I still do. She's looking after Henry this week. But, you know, I've had amazing support from her and I've got great friends and all of that. But I don't have family around because my family are all in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I've been quite alone. I don't think there's any point pretending about that, really. And I think people, like even really senior people, recognize that they know that it's not easy. Mm. And then they'll look at me and say, like, it's impressive that you can do all of this. And I'll be like, right. And the people who aren't, I can remember once going to something, like, because I have to go out a lot of evenings for work still, but when I was at Justice going out for an evening thing and this old person saying to me, oh, you know, why weren't you at this event last night? You know, I would expect the Director of Justice to have been at this thing. I remember looking at him and thinking, well, I've already been out three nights this week and I've got a four-year-old child. Like, I can't possibly be at everything. So you might expect that, but you're just not going to see me. Like, there are times that you have to choose that. So, but I think it comes back to having a pretty strong self, a sense of what I think is right and wrong, what I'm prepared to do and what I'm not prepared to do.
Yeah.
And but I think, you know, being vulnerable is not in any way a weakness. I've never thought it's a weakness.
Mm-hmm.
I think now there's increasing, like, recognition of that. And, yeah, much as I'd love to be completely kind of self-contained and in control all the time, I just think everyone does better if they're themselves.
Yeah.
And for me, that's being a bit stupid and being a bit making jokes and... Yeah,
like inhuman.
Being human. Yeah, not being human. I mean, I remember talking to a friend, in fact, the same friend I used to go and steal sushi with, not steal, we didn't steal the sushi, but steal time to have sushi when we were doing articles. She was working for a very big oil and gas company in senior role. And we were laughing and I just said, oh, I love your laugh. Like, it's so great to hear. And she said, oh, I like to hear it too. I never laugh in the office. I was like, what are you talking about? And then she told me about how she like never laughs in the office. She has a different accent she uses. Like she has a different voice that she uses. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All of this stuff, which was, I just thought, completely exhausting.
Yeah.
You know, and in the end, you know, she realized she just couldn't continue on doing that. Like it's, you know, she did it for nearly 30 years. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I've never had to bother with that. I just think it's just, it's tiring enough without having to be somebody who's not you. And then the final thing is to, in sounds stupid, but to enjoy the journey more. Like I think I, particularly at Justice, but even now, like there are things I'll do where it's just a question of getting through. So I can remember organising a really big dinner to celebrate Justice's 60th anniversary and everybody was having a really lovely time. And I can remember really seeing Master of the Rolls coming up to me saying, Andrea, like, you know, this is all so wonderful. Are you enjoying yourself? And I was like, no, I just want it over. Like, I just wanted everything to be, like, I want it over. I want it to be finished. Everyone to have had a good time, us to embrace nothing. Like, that's what I feel like far too much of the time. I mean, right. And I struggle with that now. Like, I just think, okay, I'm doing this fantastic piece of work for the Hadley. I'm doing a big interview on television. I just want it over. Like I'm not ready to actually let myself enjoy it because I just need to be a success and it over. So I need to sort of still work on that. So I did that
interesting.
Myself 20 years ago, but also last week.
Yeah. I mean, I talk to a lot of people about reframing and I know like it comes up most obviously in public speaking where what people are saying to themselves, and I know you're a very experienced public speaker, but most people who are doing it and aren't that comfortable with it or hate it are saying, I hate this. Why have I agreed to do this? I can't bear it. I don't want to do this. I wish this wasn't happening. And I talk to them about trying in their head to say, this is an amazing opportunity. How lucky am I that all these people are willing to come and listen to me? I've got things I really want to share. So you just switch what you're saying in your head and maybe like with that sort of thing, because it's on your to-do list. It's yet another thing that you've got to do and could go wrong. I want it all to go right. I want it to be done. It's like stopping and going, no, this is amazing. I'm going to now sit back and enjoy it because it's all happening. It's that sort of, can you start practicing, I guess, like,
yeah,
stepping back. No, you can't do it all the time and saying I'm going to look at this and enjoy it and think how amazing that I get to do this, because there may come a time when I'm, you know, I don't have this opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, my job now involves doing a lot of media work than I'd ever done before. And it used to fill me with dread. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it'll be like, oh, the Channel 4 news crew's coming over. Like, that's good. Like, I'm looking for, like, I'll have a tea, cup of tea ready for them, because it's an opportunity to share how bad prison policy is with a really broad audience. And, you know, the flavor of prisons now I think is getting reasonably favorable. So, I mean, even the, when I've been on kind of hostile territory on like talk TV or whatever, I've now got to the stage where I quite enjoy it.
Really? That's amazing.
Yeah, well, they're like, you know, they're just going to say what they're going to say. And I don't take any of it personally.
And you're not worried about how you're going to be judged for your performance on that thing now? That doesn't...
I regret if I say anything that's kind of sounds stupid or gets edited to sound stupid, which is... But no, I mean, I'm pretty confident on the subject matter. And then there are some things that we're just not going to agree on. I was doing a hilarious one last summer, which was on Talk TV, this sort of shock jock man, and it was about shoplifting. And I think the government announced they were going to make sentences from shoplifting up from 7 years to 14 years or something absurd. And we were having the interview, and as we were doing the interview and I was explaining that, like, most people who shoplift are shoplifting to feed addiction or because of mental health problems, all these sort of things, and, you know, locking them away for 14 years is not the answer. They put some footage on, which was of a big four-wheel drive banging into a 7-Eleven and just people jumping out with guns and, like, grabbing stuff. And I'm just saying, look, this is what you're showing. This footage
not
is
shoplifting.
Like, this is not shoplifting. Like, this is, you know, this is holding up somewhere in arms. Like, these people are really getting custodial sentences. And even he was like, oh, no, you're right. Like, it was just. So, no, I'm not too worried about all of that stuff now. I mean, you don't want to do a bad job. Like, I guess that's the thing, is that the press, the media work, you know, the media work particularly does expose you as, you know, it is quite exposing.
Yeah.
For most of my day, I can sit here and do a so-so job. not that I want to do a so-so job, but nobody's really going to judge me. It's not like I'm a surgeon. Like, we're not surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, you don't have to be on 100% of the time.
Yeah.
You really want to be, and you put that pressure on yourself to be, but I'm not a perfectionist. And I've always thought that near enough is probably good enough.
Yeah.
But it's not if you're on the top story in the ITV news, like, you don't want to come across as a moron.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think I'm now in a position where I don't do that. It's like, it's slightly scary, but I am starting to enjoy it. And if I can enjoy that, I can probably enjoy most things, I think.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, look, thank you so much for your time. And it's been such an interesting conversation. It's been really
fun.
Yeah. So everyone who's listening, sign up for Justice and sign up to the Howard League. Get their newsletters, go and look at what they're doing. Yeah. Do both of those things. You'll get an awful lot out of it. So thank you, Andrea.
Thanks.
That's all for this episode of the Women's Room Legal Division podcast. If you like this episode, do subscribe to the show and follow the Women's Room Legal Division on the links in the show notes. If you are, or if you know an amazing woman in law who you think should be on this podcast, or if there are any specific coaching topics you'd like me to cover in my standalone sessions, please do get in touch using the contact me link in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening.